This is John Udell. My guest for this week's podcast is Terry Swack. She started out as a graphic designer, transitioned into web and interaction design, and is the founder of a string of companies, including most recently Clean Culture, a consultancy dedicated to helping companies respond to the demand for clean energy and sustainable products. Well, so first of all, I think I have to congratulate you on being one of the smartest people probably ever to have managed to sell an internet company in, what was it, 1999?
Yeah.
Just in the nick of time, that was quite prescient.
Yeah, well, it seemed like the right thing to do at the time.
It obviously was.
To be completely honest, I'd had that business for 14 years.
Uh-huh.
Bootstrapped it the entire time, had never taken any investment money, never had a partner, and that's a lot of weight to carry for a long time.
So what were the elements of the business pre-internet relative to the things that then transitioned into experience design and web design?
Well, I started my career as a graphic designer, and my degree is in graphic design.
Okay.
And what I learned through that process was how to think systematically through any given type of problem. That was the underlying approach to solving visual problems.
What do you mean by a visual problem?
Unlike probably how people who aren't designers think about how design gets done. Probably imagine people sitting down at a computer and making everything all at the same time. The layout, the type choices, the colors, the use of imagery, the grid. And in a deconstructed process, you do explorations around typography. You do explorations of color. You do exploration of structure. And through those explorations, you cull out the best idea, and you begin to combine them, and then you go through some more process, and you combine better ideas, and so it's the evolution that gets you to the solution, not the visualization of an endpoint and then the execution of that. During the 80s, my clients were early 80s technology companies, education, but I got very interested in trying to bring good design to companies that didn't have good design traditionally done for them or for their customers. And at the time, it was really mainstream consumer brands. This was before design took hold in advertising agencies and before the rise of desktop publishing. And so I ended up getting a lot of clients in retail. And these were all stores that you would find if you went to South Shore Plaza.
Okay.
It was tremendous to be able to go into these places and see people interacting with things that you'd created. And so I really got to deeply understand that type of customer, the middle American, in short, the middle American demographic and psychographic. You know, we found you didn't have to design down to people anymore. People really, really responded to beautifully designed products and packaging and environments, and especially when, you know, things have to be designed anyway. So, you know, why not do it well? And it always resulted in tremendous increases in sales, measurable brand loyalty results. Yeah, it just felt good.
I suppose you could argue that it was never necessary to design down to people, that it was just a bad idea that was in circulation for a while.
Yeah, I never understood that. You know, it seems like, it probably seems like ancient history to talk about it, but I really can remember being in meetings and people saying, oh, they'll never get that. So anyway, when the 90s came and a lot of my clients went out of business, I started to look for what's next. How can I have even more more impact in my clients' businesses? All consulting companies try to go upstream and get more into strategic planning, and that's where the money is. And a friend of mine early on showed me the web in 93. And he said, listen, Terry, he said, I want to put some information here, but I want you to help me with this. And I said, okay, well, just tell me what all the constraints are and we'll figure it out. Well, this was, well before Netscape, and it was early World Wide Web. Pretty much all you could do was put in some text and change some point sizes and insert some pictures. But I saw the opportunity for design thinking to come into play here because, God, this environment is horrible.
You use the phrase design thinking?
Right. What I loop back to is where I started, which is this notion of systems thinking. That's what design thinking is. It's systems thinking. Again, I go back to the experiences of having designed for people in retail environments. One of the biggest aha moments was for this Laureate's bookstore chain. We had designed a whole in-store signing program that had to be a flexible system that could be installed in the 40 different stores. And we had to understand how people shop a bookstore.
Hmm.
And people come to a bookstore with one of two intentions, to shop or to browse.
Right, to read, yeah.
And so then you think about, well, how do you put more type, you know, a sign system, into an environment that already has more type than any place you've ever been, and none of it is branded or consistent?
Mm-hmm.
You think about that scenario, and it sounds an awful lot like what you have to think about when designing a virtual environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that kind of cracked me up a little bit was, and I'm sure you remember this, in the early to mid-90s, everybody saying, everything has changed. This mm-hmm. is all new.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, why would you throw away everything you know to try to reinvent the wheel? No, it's not new.
Yeah, I know. We hear that again nowadays in terms of social software.
Right.
It's all new. No, actually, human social interaction is pretty much a universal constant and has been for maybe 10,000 years.
Millennia old, yeah. I'm as much of an advocate for the new thing, but not at the expense of tossing out the old thing that people understand and respond to.
There's a danger of sort of the tyranny of the technologist always in these things. In fact, in the case of social software, it's particularly amusing because you have, to put it bluntly, got this group of relatively socially maladapted young white male programmers who are building these systems which are intended to reflect the complexity of human social interaction. And you wind up with things like Orkut that says in a dialogue box, you are my friend. Yes, no.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah.
So you're in transition to doing things which connect internet media to people who are trying to figure out which green products and clean energy products and sustainable products they're going to buy and use. You have been doing what you call a media company to help people do this stuff, to figure out this stuff, right?
Right.
And there's a site, Green Building Blocks.
Yes.
So talk about what Green Building Blocks is, first of all, how it works and what it does and what it's for.
Green Building Blocks is a national directory of green residential design and building professionals. The purpose of it is for architects, builders, contractors, all the kinds of professionals, build homes, to be able to find other qualified professionals to collaborate with on these projects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who have kind of come out of the green space are always skeptical. Well, do they really know how to do what they say they know how to do? And are they really qualified to be able to say that they can do this? And you know, what certifications they have? And so, you know, my attitude was that, you know, no amount of certification is going to necessarily make a difference in the marketplace in terms of who's qualified or who's not. The market's going to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And so we designed Green Building Blocks to allow each practitioner or each professional to provide as much information to convey their experience, their capabilities, their qualifications in a way that others could self-assess and make a decision for themselves whether skills that they're looking for seem to be, you know, offered by this potential partner, and then the ability to contact them and learn more.
So are you going for some of the properties of a social network? For example, the property of reputation being a commodity within the system?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I'm looking at Green Built Construction, which is one of the companies that's listed here.
Mm-hmm.
A listing that they've provided.
Right.
It's, at least in this incarnation, it's not intended to sort of monitor what the reaction has been to the work or the products that these people have done or provided.
Not yet.
Yeah. It's a very interesting topic. It would be quite unusual, probably even today, to expect to find through, let's say, a listing like this, the blog of one of these companies, and on that blog to see a narrative about the work that they've done over time. And then through the rest of the internet's interaction with that blog, to be able to find reactions to it, inbound links that would tell you about people who had good or bad experiences. This whole notion of how reputation becomes discoverable in a very decentralized way on the internet now, to the extent that people represent themselves to the internet.
Yes.
Is extremely interesting.
Yes.
For example, forgetting construction for the moment, and just think about medicine. There's starting to be a huge push for disclosure of medical outcomes, right? How well does this doctor do over time with this procedure versus another doctor? It's a very liberating but also very scary kind of thing.
You know, it's the kind of information you'd want to know, but not really.
Well, yeah, you would. If you had a choice, if you could exercise choice in the matter, you would definitely want to know. That's a fascinating sort of...
That is super interesting.
Things are going to go that way.
It's a really interesting concept of reputation becoming discoverable, because in the case of the design and building community, people are reinventing their reputations as they decide to become involved in green building.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years from now, we're not going to call it green building anymore. It will just be what building is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're in the transition from not thinking about how we use materials and impact the planet to just changing, and that it becomes part of just how we do things.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the people who are kind of getting on the bandwagon, the early adopters, were the ones who were doing it because it's the right thing to do. Now, you know, it's taken off like wildfire because it's great for business.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great way to differentiate yourself from the competition by being able to offer, you know, green services.
Yeah.
Existing companies are having to think about, you know, how to extend or expand their brand to incorporate their green or sustainable messaging. New businesses are coming to the marketplace. People who never used the internet, and this is another thing that we found, I mean, a lot of the types of consultants who work on projects, they're lighting consultants, or now there's a lot of new kind of green building specialists, because these are the people who really have the knowledge that becomes the glue for these new teams. They've never marketed themselves before, and certainly not externally to consumers. They get all their projects through their professional networks.
Yeah.
But now here's an opportunity for them to externalize themselves and describe themselves differently. So it's been very interesting in the way people have seen, you know, this opportunity in a way to describe themselves and make themselves visible.
It's probably a little bit radical to consider what I am considering, but I really do imagine a world in which at some point a professional person in any area will be really expected to have represented in some tangible way what they've done over time online in a discoverable form. You're an example of that, actually. I mean, you know, you're someone who happens to have been online long enough that without you even sending me the background information that you did send me before this interview, I was able to look around and see, okay, I can get a sense of what the arc of this career has been just by what I can find online.
Yeah.
That's only true right now for those of us who are sort of pathologically visible on the internet by today's standards, you know, and who have been on it for a period of time. Do you think that it will be the case that this will become more standard and more common for people in all kinds of different professions?
I absolutely think that this is a trend that will just continue to persist, because people are demanding more and more transparency from their government,
mm-hmm.
from their service providers, now from their healthcare providers. But at the same time, government and business in particular, is seeing that it's good business to be more transparent. And I think a great example of this is companies that have stepped up to implementing triple bottom line reporting standards and are filing GRI reports. It's the Global Reporting Index.
Yep.
The premise is that, you know, why is it that as a society, you know, that we value only the financial bottom line of a business to measure the company's value? You know, it isn't like God handed down GAAP accounting practices on Mount Sinai. There's lots of different ways to measure value. There are several hundred companies, including, you know, many major corporations, that are writing and filing and posting these reports, who are beginning to measure their performance differently. And believe me, this is a challenge, because there are no standards like GAAP to measure social responsibility or environmental impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so companies of all sizes now are trying to work on processes to account for and implement systems that will measure and, you know, convey the successes of their efforts in these areas.
You would call it a quasi-standard?
It's a way of reporting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very interesting organization called CERES, C-E-R-E-S, which the GRI was born from. CERES is an NGO that has a lot of for-profit companies and non-profit companies. Their major initiative is to work with the Wall Street community to educate fund managers and investors about how to evaluate companies and saying, you know, if you're looking at doing, you know, big investments, and particularly like pension fund managers who are managing long-term huge portfolios, saying, guys, if you're only looking at the financial performance of these companies, and these companies are not measuring or evaluating long-term their impact of peak oil and climate change, then you do not have an accurate picture of these companies. These companies are, in fact, lying to you about the financial health of their companies. And Ceres has been extraordinarily successful in getting funds like CalPERS and TIA, CREF, to now only invest in companies who disclose. And, you know, we've seen a lot of movement in big companies like, you know, Walmart and GE and, you know, Toyota, the ones who are kind of poster children now. But that's what it takes, is the top-down, the big movers, the big brands being very vocal about it, and people, you know, other companies will follow suit. I'm very up on the trend.
So in terms of the energy efficiency in the built environment, there's an interesting contrast between the residential sector and the commercial sector. So another guy that I talked to for this series, his name is Mike Frost, and he has a company that goes into these big retail stores like Michael's and Petco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got a system for, you reminded me that the term is demand response, right? They've got a system for controlling the energy use, not just within these big buildings, but across networks of them, trading off load with the grid. It's an easier target because these are, you know, each one of these buildings is the equivalent of something like 30 or 40 homes, right? So you can have a bigger impact.
Right.
You know, you do one thing and it has a bigger impact. You know, another aspect of it is that they are very visible. And so they're more likely to be feeling the heat in terms of having to do this kind of disclosure and reporting. And they're also subject to PR consideration.
Yep.
One of the points that he made was that the expectations are beginning to change. And so he mentioned that one of these stores, when during a rolling brownout in California, they had to let the temperature drift up and dim the lights in the store. They put a sign on the front that said, you know, please understand that we're doing this because it's a brownout and we're trying to help everybody. And that rather than people being upset about the fact that it was warm and dark in the store, they actually felt good about the company being on the ball.
Yeah.
There's that whole set of factors in play on that front that make it relatively easier to actually get something accomplished than in the residential environment, which is why this guy's company isn't trying to deal with that, right? Because now it's much more distributed, much more decentralized, much more difficult to do any kind of retrofitting, and much more difficult to account for the results. There's sort of no obvious pressure on people to make things happen other than anything which can be clearly cost justified in terms of what the payoff is going to be for an investment.
Yeah.
Being that you are a media company, which is in this space trying to help move things along, how do you think about and deal with those challenges?
Well, you know, just one thing to keep in mind is that companies, like you were describing as the customers of your friend, they buy power differently than consumers do. Big companies can buy power wholesale,
mm-hmm.
In power contracts. And so there's a lot more flexibility in the price they pay for it, you know, and when they use it. And so companies that are doing demand response programs, it's easier to get customers, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's more money to be made in commercial energy.
Mm-hmm.
Our homes, we're still all what the utilities call rate payers. You're going to pay what we tell you, and you're going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't like it, and they're not going to take that anymore. And you know, states like California, where they've had, you know, the most visible and clearly the most painful experiences managing their power demands, have made an enormous investment in installing new meters in people's homes. And I think it's by 2010, all California homes will have these new meters that not only will allow the power companies to charge real-time pricing, but also will allow consumers to sell power back into the grid if they're generating their own power.
In the medium term, there's not going to be that many people who are producing power. One of the things I wonder about, though, is, and this gets back to the question of how people cost justify green products or energy efficient appliances, is that it's really impossible to know because your telephone bill is exquisitely itemized and your electricity bill is one number.
Right.
How would you know how much power your old refrigerator is drawing? What would be the difference between that one and a new efficient one and what the payoff would be?
Right.
So those are really vexing problems, right?
Yeah. Your point is well taken, which is people want to change. People are aware now for all the reasons, you know, it's expensive, war, you know, we understand that global warming is real. You know, they want to make changes, but they want to make changes that count. And so now it's about the companies who are offering these products and services to begin to explain to consumers in ways that are understandable why making this purchase decision makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
How are we explaining it? What information are we giving them? How are we measuring? And we're going to see a lot more. There are a lot of initiatives going on to help people understand exactly that question.
So, for example?
One that's front and center but hasn't been able to do as good of a job as a privately funded brand is Energy Star.
Mm-hmm.
Energy Star is probably the U.S. government's almost best-kept brand secret in terms of the actual impact that they've had working with businesses to get them to manufacture both Energy Star compliant homes as well as Energy Star compliant products. And those products are being manufactured to a voluntary standard. This is not mandated by the government. The amount of energy that's been saved by people buying these products every year in the billions and billions of dollars. You know, unfortunately, Energy Star doesn't have the mechanism or the budget to get that story out there or even to better support the people inside these manufacturing companies to be able to bubble that story up to the surface to get it out there to consumers. This is one of the trends that we will begin to see is that the companies who are manufacturing sustainably or making more energy efficient products are going to work on finding ways to tell the consumer about that. There's going to be a lot of brand loyalty up for grabs. Companies that figure out, it's exactly the story that you conveyed about people, the people felt better about the company for telling them that the reason that the store was warm and dark.
Right. So is your new venture partly about trying to get those stories more disseminated?
Yes, that is exactly right.
Okay.
What I found over the several years that I was working on the Beam, but in talking to so many of these companies, both manufacturing companies and service providers, was that one, there really was no forum to tell these stories, and two, there really wasn't the demand for these stories. But now that there's the demand, these companies have to get organized, figure out who needs to be involved in creating these stories and how we're going to tell them and where. In big companies, their environmental initiatives, their innovation initiatives, their design initiatives, you know, all involve sustainability, but they're all across the company. And so that's why, you know, what you see now is big companies with very strong leadership at the top, like a Toyota, like a Walmart, like a Goldman Sachs, whose leadership has the vision, they're able to get it together and get that message out there.
Your new venture, Clean Culture, is going to do what in that space then?
Clean Culture will work with companies, both startups and existing companies, to understand their customers or their consumers and figure out what's the right thing to be making and how do we tell people about what it is that we're making and why it makes a difference.
Okay.
And at the same time, to have as much understanding about what people want and expect to be able to inform those decisions to accelerate, you know, the right thing happening. You know, the time has come. You know, the consciousness has shifted. People want it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we get it out there?
Mm-hmm.
The events of the last 18 months, starting with Katrina, through the enduring war, through
yep.
you know, An Inconvenient Truth being a box office hit, to you know, the final irony is the president in his State of the Union address actually acknowledging the existence of global warming and calling for strong clean energy goals. You know, finally, being very clear about the threat of our energy security. We've shifted. We're ready. And I liken it all back to what the internet was like in the mid-90s. You know, it went from, it's like anything. You have the early adopters. So you have like the hardcore greenies. And I liken them to the technologists, right, who are the ones who like get it going, talk about it, but are very insular. And then finally, you know, like, okay, designers and business people get involved and becomes more open and people become more aware of it.
Yeah, and we have the advantage now that we have the internet as a communication substrate.
Yeah.
You know, one of the huge bottlenecks for anyone to sort of get over the activation threshold with something like this is wanting to know, well, what's been the experience of someone else who has done that? That's what people really want to know.
Right, exactly.
If I'm going to buy a pellet stove, I want to see one in my friend's house. I want to see how it operates. I want to talk to them about what it's really like to operate it and clean it and maintain it, how much heat it really gives off, you know, what the trade-off is versus
yep.
oil, right? Prior to 10 years ago, the only way that that information could spread was direct word of mouth.
Right.
Now we have the capability to package up these stories and make them much more virally available.
Yep.
And it's a huge advantage if we if we play our cards right.
Absolutely. Yeah. How did we even live before the internet? How did we know anything before the internet?
Well, at least we were born at a time where we had the good fortune to be around when it happened.
Yep, that's true.
That's about all you can say about that.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, likewise.
Are you going to try to come down for the Green Build Conference?
When is that?
March 13th through the 15th.
Well, yeah, I'll be away.
Oh, not Green Build. I'm sorry. It's the Building Energy Conference put on by an organization called NESE here in New England. It's the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association. It's a conference and trade show for renewable energy and green building professionals.
Mm-hmm.
But the trade show floor is very interesting, and you can see a lot of manufacturers and service providers in solar and green building.
It would be. So anyone can go? Is it free to the public?
I think there's a nominal charge for the trade show.
Okay. That would be an interesting thing to see.
Yeah. And if people are interested, the website address, if you go to NESEA.org, NESE.org,
mm-hmm.
you'll see the information about the Building Energy 07 conference.
Maybe, or maybe not, that thing is going to get sort of 3 minutes on the 6 o'clock news.
I bet you it won't even. Oh, maybe it will. Maybe this year it will. Maybe this year it will.
If it does, it'll get like 3 minutes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, there's nothing to stop someone from walking around with a camcorder and getting an hour or an hour and a half.
Right.
The kind of thing that the TV news would spend 10 seconds in one booth and 10 seconds in another booth.
Right.
Someone who really was interested in documenting what is the breadth of stuff that's available in this space right now could walk around and could spend 5 to 10 minutes with a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
And the thing is, so what if there's a relatively small number of people who would watch that? The fact is, it doesn't really cost anything to do it.
Exactly.
You know, and for people who did care, you could put that information out there, and then the people who didn't manage to get down to Boston on those days would have access to it.
It's super interesting. I mean, really, you'd never know about these companies.
Right.
But over the years, I've definitely seen the size of company and the caliber of the brand definitely increase.
Maybe you should take your camcorder.
You know, I just maybe could.
Yeah. Get a friend to help you. But it could be anybody. I mean, bring along a high school kid with a tripod and a camcorder to help you.
Yeah.
It'd be a great class project for them.
Yeah, that's true. All right, John, take care.
Yeah, you too.